the slipper orchid, one of the world's most beautiful and rare exotic flowers. Also, one of the most valuable. You can kind of just smell the scent of a scandal. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, it's all about orchids. First, writer Craig Pittman takes us on a twisted tale of backstabbing, greed, and mystery surrounding an endangered and beloved slipper orchid. Plus, later in the hour, we talk with a local guy about his underground flower oasis. Hear how a passion for plants has spawned a business of thousands of cave-dwelling orchids. The conversation blooms on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. In China, they symbolize refinement and innocence. For the Aztecs, they symbolize power and strength. And in Victorian England, beauty and luxury. There are many things that come to mind when one thinks of the orchid flower. Today, we find out the lengths to which people will go to cultivate, protect, grow, and keep orchid flowers. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Join us for the first half of the hour. The Orchid Hour on Central Standard, that is a man who weaved together an intriguing yarn about a rare orchid at a botanical garden in Florida and the scandal that ensued after that. Our guest joining us now from Florida is Craig Pittman, a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and author of the book Scent of a Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. Craig Pittman, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how did you come across this story, your regular environmental issues beat reporter? How did you come across this story?
Well, in covering the environment for the Tampa Bay Times, I get to cover all kinds of weird stories, you know, Everglades battling pythons for supremacy in the Everglades and things like that. But this was by far the strangest one. One of my sources called me up and said, have you been following what's been going on with this orchid situation? And I said, not really. And he filled me in and said, you should get over to court and look at the court files about what's going on with this thing. And when I did, I realized it was quite a bizarre story. So I started following it and was there for most of it. I missed the very beginning, but I was there for most of it and was able to go back and interview people and look at documents and reconstruct it.
This orchid thing is how it started out.
Yes.
What did you know about orchids before you started following the story?
I knew that I should leave them alone because I tend to kill everything I touch when I try and grow stuff. But I know that people, some people are very obsessed with orchids. There's something about the collector gene in some people where, you know, they can collect coins, they can collect paintings, they can collect postage stamps, and most people are just fine getting whatever they can get their hands on. But then there are a few people who they just become obsessed, and they have to have the rarest, they have to have the most beautiful. And there are some orchid people who are like that, and they go to extremes, and some of them went to extremes with this particular orchid.
You have a character in your book named Guido who actually punched somebody out at customs.
Yes.
over an orchid. And
yes,
these characters that you forge in the book and that you bring to life seem so unreal, but they are in fact real people.
I actually had to assure someone at one of my author signings that yes, this is a nonfiction book. In fact, if you look on the back of the book, I think it's the only book classified this way. It's classified as true crime/gardening.
True crime/gardening. That's good. Speaking of true crime/gardening, take us into the Marie Selby Botanical Garden in Sarasota, Florida. Not your typical place for a federal search warrant, but tell us about the place where the drama started.
No, it's a beautiful place. People who visit Florida like to go there to stroll the grounds and see all the beautiful plants. They have a very wide collection of orchids and bromeliads because that's what they specialize in. It's a prime place not just for tourism but also for weddings. Lots of beautiful outdoor weddings take place there, but it also has this scientific component that frankly was the whole reason it was set up in the first place, was to create this orchid identification center where there would be orchid specialists, orchid scientists who would be there and would be available when orchid collectors brought in plants from the wild and could show it to them and say, what have I got? Have I got something that's never been seen before, or is this something that was found, you know, back in the 1800s and hasn't been seen since, or whatever? And so at the time of the events in this book, the Orchid Identification Center was in something of an eclipse. The people in charge of the garden had sort of lost interest in orchids and instead were paying more attention to treetops, ecosystems, and the rainforest and that kind of thing.
So you're looking for a panacea, and
yes.
In walks one of your cast of characters,
yes.
Michael Kovac. He's central to the plot. Who is Michael Kovac?
Michael Kovac is the most intriguing and most contradictory character in the book. He is a small-time Virginia orchid grower who wants to hit it big, sort of like the Orchid Identification Center guys. He needs a big payday. He needs some big discovery. And he's friends with a guy named Lee Moore, whose nickname is The Adventurer, because Lee's been traipsing around the jungles in South America for 30 years, finding all kinds of plants that are now named after him. I once made the mistake of calling Lee an orchid smuggler to his face, and Lee got very upset and said, no, I never smuggled orchids. I used the orchids to hide what I was really smuggling.
As I was reading that about Lee Moore, I would think he's been in the jungles all over the world. You would think maybe he'd come up with a more original, intrepid name than The Adventurer.
Well, he says that's what people were calling him initially as a sort of a satirical thing, but it ended up being true.
Right.
So Kovac tells him, boy, Lee, I'm so jealous of you. You've got all these plants named after you. I just wish I could have one named after me. And, as Lee says, beware the costs of fame, beware of getting what you wish for. Because Kovac and Lee Moore went down to Peru, and Lee sent him up into the Andes with his driver and his car and said, go up there and look around. And Kovac finds this astounding thing that when he brings it to Selby Gardens, they declare it to be the most amazing orchid discovered in the last 100 years.
And enter the guest of honor, the slipper orchid, the rare Peruvian flower, the scientific
yes.
name, Phragmopidium Kovacii.
Yes.
Where did that
very
come
good,
from?
Very good. When Kovac brought it to Selby Gardens, I should back up. When he showed it to Lee Moore initially, and Lee said, you've got it. You've got the holy grail of orchids. This thing is astounding. Get it to Selby Gardens, and they'll name it after you, and don't slow down to apply for any permits because you won't get one. So he sticks it in his luggage with his dirty underwear and waltzes through the Miami airport with it and takes it to Selby Gardens in Sarasota, and the scientists there all went nuts because they had been seeing pictures of this thing that they knew it was being sold on the black market for $10,000 a plant, but they had no hope of actually getting their hands on one. And here comes a guy that they'd never met before, walks in and says, here's this plant I found. Can you name it after me? And they said, sure. So they named it Phragmopedium Kovacii after Michael Kovac, which one of their critics later said was tantamount to hanging a sign on his back saying, please come arrest me.
Right. So everybody had something to gain in this beginning stage as the drama unfolded.
Yes.
Kovac has this Kovacii thing named after him, and the Botanical Gardens is looking for a spark for its orchid classification program,
right.
And this spark is it. I'll give our listeners a sense of what this rare orchid looks like. You describe it as petals as broad as a boulevard, their color a shade of pinkish purple that looked like a frozen explosion, a freeze-framed blast of raspberry fireworks painted on the richest velvet. Does that begin to describe this rare flower?
Not really. I mean, words sort of fail me. It is truly a magnificent thing to see. And well, let me put it this way. A friend of mine who is involved in orchids and has been for quite some time finally got to see one at an orchid show in Miami not long ago, and he said it is everything you described it as. He said, I couldn't get over it. It's the most magnificent orchid I've ever seen. So.
And these are reactions from people who aren't orchid enthusiasts.
Well, that guy was. That guy was. But even people who are not orchid enthusiasts see it and go, wow, that's really something. And you have to know, too, that most slipper orchids are not that large. But this one, the stalk rises a full foot, and the blossom is as big as a man's hand. And the colors change very subtly, but they change over time as the blossom ages. So it's just a fascinating thing, even if you don't know much about flowers, just to look at it and to see and to sort of drink in its majesty.
And you definitely drunk in its majesty with your retelling of the account. Speaking of which, people got drunk off of its majesty. So when did things start to go awry at the Selby Botanical Garden?
Well, a few days after Selby rushed into print the name of this new flower, beating by just a few days one of their sharpest critics who was working on the same scientific description, they sent out a press release about it touting this big find for their Orchid Identification Center, and the government of Peru took note and filed a formal complaint with the United States government, and all hell broke loose, basically. Pretty shortly after that, you had armed federal officers showing up at Kovac's door at 7:45 in the morning. They wanted to search his greenhouse for illegal flowers. A grand jury was impaneled in Tampa and began raining subpoenas down on everybody involved, including the scientists who had handled the plant. And it just from there, it got weird, frankly.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're having a conversation with Craig Pittman, the author of Sin of a Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. He also covers environmental issues for the Tampa Bay Times. You talk about the raid of Michael Kovac's house. Michael Kovac, for our listeners who may just be joining us, went to Peru and commandeered, smuggled through a rare orchid by the name of Phragmeridian kovacii, named after him, a rare slipper orchid. And so bring us to that raid. Tell us about Mary Holt, the U.S. Fishers and Wildlife Service investigator. She pursues the case with sort of a Columbo vibe, and she shows up one day at Kovac's house with a guy named Roddy Gable. Suddenly, it's like an episode of CSI for flowers. tell us
about
that.
That's a good comparison. Well, initially, when Mary Holt went to Kovac's house, she went by herself, and she did this classic investigative technique of playing dumb. She said, "I'm looking into flower smuggling. I've never really been involved in that kind of investigation before. Educate me." And so Kovac told her everything he knew about orchids, wrote out a 7-page affidavit for her about what he'd done in Peru and everything, and said, "You know, there are lots of people involved in smuggling, and I can steer you to them," and so forth. And she never told him, "Hey, you're the guy we're looking at." But there was enough in that affidavit to implicate him, and so very shortly afterwards, she showed up again with a search warrant and with several armed federal officers, including Roddy Gable, who is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's top orchid expert. And yes, they have an orchid expert.
Yes, they do.
And they searched the greenhouse. They confiscated flowers, although they did not find any more Phragmopedium kovacii, which is what they were really looking for. But they also, and this is what made Kovac particularly mad, they confiscated his proposal for a new reality TV show called The Orchid Hunter, which would star Michael Kovac.
Wow. Wow. Took away his chance at stardom.
Well, yes.
In the book, you quote James Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence chief and an orchid enthusiast in his off time, whatever that is.
Yeah.
He said that most species of orchids, it's not the fittest, but the most deceptive that survive. What do you think he meant by that, and how does that fit into this tale?
Well, he was specifically talking about the pollination, the way that the pollen is spread from flower to flower, that often the blooms have some sort of a scent that mimics the scent of the insect's mating practices, or in some other way tricks the insect into coming inside. And once it gets in, a lot of them, they can't get out unless they go past where the pollen is. And then they deposit the pollen that they have and take on a new deposit, and then they're able to slip out through the back through a very small hole that is just the right size just for them. And so that's why he was referring to them using these deceptive practices in order to continue to spread. But also, I was using it in the context of there were a lot of people involved in this case who weren't necessarily telling the truth all the time. Kovac himself told at least 3, maybe 5 versions of his story of what happened that day. Lee Moore admitted to me that he had lied to federal investigators because he was trying to protect Kovac. Kovac tells me that he suspects Lee Moore was actually protecting himself. There are all kinds of deceit going on in this story. And I think I admitted that at one point I felt like I was watching a performance of Rashomon in a hall of mirrors.
Yes, an allusion to the famous Japanese play later turned into a movie where everybody's telling the same version of the same story with different spins on it.
Yes.
All types of people, speaking of Rashomon, are getting involved with this intrigue over this orchid. Were you surprised that there were so many who were angling to bend the rules on one hand and pass the buck on the other with this?
I was, in a way, because you have in your mind this image of people who are interested in botany as being fairly nice and sedate and that kind of thing. But these folks, they were going out in the wild. They were battling leeches. They were battling each other. One chapter of the book is called The Hike from Hell, and it's about these people who are interested in seeing this orchid growing in the wild and all that they go through and all that they put up with just to get out there and see it. And when they get out there, then they're offered this entire field of flowers for $10,000. And so they two fairly respectable guys sit down and try and figure out, okay, how are we going to do this so that we don't get in trouble? And they're really sorely tempted to do it, even though they know it's probably illegal. And so just that lure of, we can have this thing. We can have this thing that nobody else has, and it's this incredibly desirable thing. And how are we going to make this work? It's reminded several people of the Maltese Falcon, frankly, of everyone chasing this wonderfully desirable object that then kind of blows up in their face whenever they finally get it.
Again, making allusions to cinematic masterpieces, the Humphrey Bogart Maltese Falcon, rare bird indeed. Speaking of which, coming up at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to someone from a place called Bird Botanicals, so that matches perfectly. We're going to continue our orchid discussion in this Orchid Hour. We're talking with Craig Pittman, the author of Scent of a Scandal, Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid. At this point in this investigation, Selby officials at the Selby Botanical Garden in Florida try to close ranks, and there's a local angle to it. They actually contacted the Missouri Botanical Gardens to try to close ranks about a sort of witch hunt against botanical gardens. Tell us about that.
Well, they contacted their counterparts at all the botanical gardens around the country and said, hey, you know, we should all work together. This thing that's happening to us, it could happen to anyone. Help us out. And the response was just radio silence, according to the Selby Gardens people. They said, you know, everybody was like, sorry, you're on your own. You know, this is not something that we would ever want to be involved in, and good luck to you. And it was sort of a sobering moment for the people in charge at Selby Gardens. And in the meantime, that united front started to crumble as well under pressure from federal investigators, federal prosecutors, as some of the scientists became state witnesses and agreed to testify against their colleagues in return for immunity.
Now, tell us how a case such as this is built. You outline it very eloquently in the book, but who is the investigative authority and who does it get kicked up to?
Very good question. This case was handled as a violation of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, C-I-T-E-S, which orchid people, by and large, hate. They hate that treaty because they say it is terrible for protecting orchids in their native habitat. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is in charge of investigating violations of that treaty. And so that's why Agent Holt was the investigator assigned from the Fish and Wildlife Service to investigate it. Ultimately, it went to the U.S. Department of Justice, to a special unit within the Justice Department that investigates environmental crimes. And a prosecutor named Eleanor Colburn was in charge of it, and she took charge of the grand jury that was investigating. I was very lucky that I was able to obtain transcripts of some of the grand jury testimony in order to kind of recreate for people what it was like to be inside that grand jury room being peppered with questions about these endangered flowers that were being smuggled in through the Miami airport, and frankly, just how incredulous some of the grand jurors were that all of this was going on over a flower. Ultimately, the grand jury makes a decision as to whether someone should be charged with a crime, and then they issue an indictment, and then that person is facing, you know, federal charges. Or, and this is what also sometimes happens, is while the grand jury is working, the Justice Department is negotiating with the target to get them to admit their guilt to some particular criminal charge, and then they are charged with that and end up having to plead guilty. So it's sort of running on two tracks at the same time.
The key element that makes this case, for lack of a better word, sprout, is the botanical garden tried to cover its own topsoil, for lack of a better word. Tell us about that sort of clandestine act of the botanical garden trying to cover its tracks after they get this rare slipper orchid, the Phragmeridium kovacii, from Michael Kovac.
Well, I don't want to give away too much because the book is sort of structured like a mystery.
It is.
But they had an idea that, you know, this thing that Kovac has given us, this may be the only one in the whole world, and in order to create an official type specimen, we have to kill it. So maybe we shouldn't kill all of it. Maybe we should take a piece. And so there was that consideration. And in the meantime, they're worried about his paperwork. Even though they accepted the plant from him, they didn't necessarily believe his story about how he got it to them. So they're starting to think, well, maybe we need to cover our butts, frankly, by sending a piece of it back, or sending this type specimen back to Peru. And so they're in discussions with someone in Peru to become a co-author on their scientific description in order to give them some cover from any sort of legal ramifications. But at the same time, and I should add, the scientists very strongly argued, and so did the administration at Selby Gardens, we're not the police. It's not up to us to catch people who are smuggling. It's up to the Fish and Wildlife Service to do it. And so on the one hand, they were trying to avoid getting in trouble, but on the other hand, they were arguing it's not up to us to make sure that things were done legally.
So bending the rules on one hand, passing the buck on the other is sort of the recurring theme in your in your book.
And you mentioned about Guido Brehm, the German scientist, and his argument is everybody in the botanical garden institutions, they're all doing the same thing. He was arguing that because of the way the rules are structured, it's almost impossible to do things the right way, and so everyone sort of does it with a nod and a wink and a nudge, and no one asks questions, or at least they didn't until this Selby Gardens case happened.
You mentioned Guido and the German botanist. Tell us about Guido. You have somebody in your mystery book called Guido. I know you were just like salivating when
well,
you saw that.
Well, he's a fascinating character. He's a very well-educated, widely read, well-respected expert on orchid taxonomy. And he was writing, he's also a somewhat, he doesn't like this word, but he's a somewhat pugnacious personality too. He was writing a book on a particular type of slipper orchids, and he found out there was a specimen that had been collected in 1905 off, I think, the coast of Indonesia, and was in a bottle of alcohol in Copenhagen in a museum. And so he wrote to someone at the museum and said, could you send me that? I'd like to examine it. And so the person put it in a box and shipped it to him. And the box was held up at the border by German customs authorities who said, you're violating the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species by shipping this thing. You don't have any receipts. You don't have any permits. And Guido Brehm went nuts on him. He said, this flower is dead. It's not covered by the CITES conventions. And, you know, why are you holding this up? And there's no receipt because it's not for sale. I'm just borrowing it. And he said he after talking to the guy for an hour and a half and seeing the customs official smirking at him, he lost his temper and punch the man out, which was not a solution by any means.
when an expert on orchid taxonomy punches you out, that's a story to tell.
Oh, yes.
Or perhaps one that you don't want to tell.
Well, he's a little rueful about this being his big claim to fame now, but he says, you know, if it happened again, I would probably do it again.
Wow. Leave it to Guido.
Yes.
There's a substantial black market for orchids that you discovered in the reporting and unraveling of this tale. Tell us about that.
Well, it was interesting. In addition to what was going on with Kovac, there was a parallel case involving some people that Kovac knew who did wind up being indicted for running a long-term orchid smuggling business out of Peru. And when they were caught, those two guys both tried to lessen their punishment by giving up all kinds of secrets about orchid smuggling. They were talking about how the Phragmopedium kovacii, once it was identified by Selby Gardens, that collectors went into the jungle and just stripped every site they could find of this particular plant because there was a huge demand for it on the black market. And they were shipping it across the border into Ecuador, and from Ecuador it was going to Germany or other countries, and some of them wound up obviously in the United States as well.
You've covered environmental issues for a while. Is this another case of human profit and prestige over preservation, these themes that we're seeing in man versus nature conversations that we're having in these days and times?
Oh, certainly. And there are even broader themes as well. I mentioned about Lee Moore, the adventurer, and the things he was smuggling. Among the other stuff he smuggled were pre-Columbian artworks. And his justification for taking, say, he actually took an entire temple wall out of Mexico at one point. And his justification was, well, if I leave it there, it'll just crumble and it'll get bulldozed by progress. But if I take it out and take it to a museum, then people will study it and they'll be able to understand what was going on back then. It'll be an advancement for science. And so the justification for a lot of the orchid smuggling is, well, if I left it in the jungle, the habitat would be destroyed by new roads being built, by other things that are being built in developing South America. Whereas if I can take it out and sell it, some collector will propagate it and it will guarantee that it continues on. And of course, I'll make money. So there's that as well.
And you have Michael Kovac, who along that vein insists pretty much the whole time that his pursuit with this orchid is almost purely altruistic.
Well, he switched back and forth. You know, like I said, he's a very contradictory character. And in some instances, he told the story as, I'm a savvy businessman and I saw an opportunity and I took it. And then sometimes he would tell the story as, I did this on behalf of science. I did it because, you know, I wanted to preserve this wonderful thing that I'd found. Ultimately, it may have been more ego than anything else that, you know, he knew Lee Moore had found all these plants and had them named after him. And what he really wanted was to have his name on a spectacular plant. And he got it. He got his wish. But, you know, as Lee Moore pointed out, be careful what you wish for.
He also got something that's also quite dubious, as well as funny, as well as something that could only be told in true fiction, as it were. What is the Kovacai Disco?
Oh, yes, there's a picture on the back of the book. This is my favorite picture. The Kovacai Disco Bar in the town of Moyobamba, which is a town in Peru that is known as the Orchid City. There actually is now a statue to the Phragmocopedium Kovacai, and near that statue is a bar that is named for it with a neon representation of the flower on it, which... when one of the people I was talking to told me about it, I said, "Oh my God, you have to send me pictures of that." And he did, and it was like, "Okay, I know what's going to be the picture on the back of the book. That's for sure."
What's next for you? Shopping a movie option or what?
Well, I wish. I think it would make an excellent movie, but I'm just continuing to plug away covering environmental stories here in Florida. I've been writing about Florida panthers and alligator trappers and other fun subjects like that.
Not the Florida Panthers football team.
No, not the hockey team. No, the actual state animal, the Florida Panther.
The actual state animal.
It's an interesting story, but it might make a book someday. But I don't know what the ending is yet.
Not going to connect the hockey team to it.
No.
All right. We've been talking with Tampa Bay Times reporter Craig Pittman about his book "Scent of a Scandal: Greed, Betrayal, and the World's Most Beautiful Orchid." That's the name of his book. He's also a reporter, as I mentioned, with the Tampa Bay Times. Craig Pittman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, but our Orchid Hour continues with a local grower with just as much passion as any other flower grower or orchid enthusiast. More on the alluring properties of orchids as this conversation continues to bloom. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. A new meaning for the phrase, "so easy a caveman can do it," is about to unfurl here in this part of the hour. The lighting, humidity, and temperature in a local cave are carefully controlled to create an environment that nurtures more than 6,300 orchids and other types of tropical plants growing there. And where's this cave? Well, it's right here on 23rd Street in Kansas City. Joining us now is David Bird, owner of Bird's Botanicals, which is inside that quote-unquote cave at the Interstate Underground Storage Building right here in Kansas City, as I mentioned. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, if you're just joining us, listeners, we just heard a story in the last half hour about how orchid collectors, botanical gardens officials, and everyone in between lie, cheat, and steal over orchids. Now we have a local orchid grower here. Tell us now, David, what's the big deal about orchids and this Phragmopedium Kovacai?
Well, it was really interesting what you found out this morning, and mine was ready to bloom this morning.
Yours was ready to bloom this morning.
But it wasn't the actual species. What I have is a hybrid of that plant, and what you found out was how it was, you know, spread back into the United States through all different countries. And I had friends that were very much involved with that plant.
They actually went to Peru.
Yes. And they actually sowed the seed in a test tube, basically, and were able to then to get seedlings, which were then legally able to be brought out of the country.
So you were familiar with this intrigue as it was going on? Some of it.
Yeah.
You were following it.
Right. I haven't read the book, which I will starting tomorrow. But knowing enough of the people that are involved and others that they were able to get the plants growing out of the country into the United States and spread through orchid growers through the whole country.
What's so fascinating about orchids? You brought in a chocolate orchid, a hybrid. It smells exactly like chocolate, little orchids, and then next to it, a beautiful sort of cacophony of sort of a magenta and white mix. Tell us about it.
Well, that's a Phalaenopsis, or the moth orchid. And it's one of the newest colors. It's called Harlequin.
Harlequin.
And it's called Firebird. Of course, anything with bird, I'm all about it. So that's kind of cool. And then the chocolate one is an Oncidium, or Dancing Doll Orchid. And that's a hybrid. And I met the fellow that developed that plant, and it was just a fluke that it came out like chocolate.
Harlequins and Dancing Dolls, we will have pictures of this on our website at kcur.org for those who are wondering what these beautiful orchids look like and why everybody's making such a big deal over these orchids. When did you first discover orchids, like truly discover orchids?
35 years ago.
35 years ago. Tell us about that.
My parents took me to Hawaii as a kid, and I had an interest in plants. I bought my first 5 plants, and I've been hooked on orchids ever since.
Why is there such a lucrative black market, do you think, for orchids?
Well, Craig got into a lot of it, and basically the CITES is what makes it illegal to transfer these species in, from country to country. Basically, by limiting the amount of plants that you can get in, makes the value go up really high. And
wow.
So I've known of plants that have sold for $10,000 to $15,000 a piece.
One plant for $15,000?
Yes.
Who sets this market? The black market itself or the
yes.
buyers or what?
Well, whoever finds this new plant and smuggles it or puts it up for sale basically can pretty much command whatever somebody will pay.
So the smuggler makes the market?
Yeah. And, of course, with Kovakii, what was so unusual about it, not only was it very large, it was huge, but it was a different color that we didn't know existed. So even though the plant's very difficult to grow, I've never had one and really don't need one because I would probably kill it just like everybody else. But as a parent, by using that plant with other orchids and crossing them, now we can create a whole new range of colors that weren't available until the discovery of that one.
Are you worried about upsetting ecosystems at all by doing hybrid crossings, or is this strictly for cosmetic value or for scientific curiosity? Are you worried about that at all?
Well, that's kind of out of my realm. I'm not the guy smuggling, and I'm not the one
right.
having to go to jail. I want to capitalize on it in the respect that I can buy plants from other growers that are using Kovakii as a parent.
Right.
And being the first ones to get to see what the flowers are coming out, what color, what shape, and what is that plant contributing to the gene pool to really make it outstanding. And this morning before I came over here, I had one in bud, and it's a cross between Sedanii, which is a small pink, and Kovakii, which is a large purple, and it looks like the bud is very dark. And so I looked at it, it wasn't open yet, and I was like, oh, man, I got to watch this. This is going to be great. And I bloomed one last week, and it's beautiful. The first day it comes out, it was perfect. If I took it to an orchid show, I could get it awarded.
And it's interesting to hear the story of it. This guy, random guy, Michael Kovac, the Virginia orchid grower who goes to Peru and sneaks this rare flower out of the country, suddenly gets it named after him.
Yeah, well, anybody can get a plant named if you discover it, or if you can get a plant awarded, and then you register it, and basically getting a plant awarded, maybe they're not new species, but if you go through the right process and get plants awarded, you get to name them.
But the story behind it is kind of dubious, so it's kind of bittersweet for that guy, pretty much.
It kind of is, but, you know, he's going to go down the record books as the most famous orchid grower ever.
Yeah, he is.
I'm right with him.
Do you make sure you adhere to the local, regional, national, and international standards about what you're allowed to grow?
Yeah, pretty much I do. The United States is a lot more fussy about, you know, what we do than other countries. It's kind of a shame. We see all these pictures of all these fantastic orchids growing all over the world, and it's like, well, we can't really have them, you know, and it's like, well, what do we do? Well, so how do you introduce new things if you don't have any new material to work with? So it makes it kind of tough, but, you know, there's 25,000 species of orchids, so we've got plenty of plant material to work with.
You say it makes it kind of tough. Do you feel at times that the rules are too strict or right where they need to be or what?
Well, I think they're too strict in the fact that we're losing that genetic material to create new and better hybrids. So not only just for the value of that individual species, but just the potential of what that plant can do. And I'm seeing it already with Kovakii, is that by getting the hybrids, I'm seeing plants that nobody else has ever bloomed before.
You said there are about 25,000 different variations or species of orchid. You grow about 6,300, approximately 6,300 different variations there?
Well, I have a lot of hybrids, Mariclones, seedlings, as well as a lot of species. And, you know, I probably have about 10,000 plants right now. I lose track. I'm not even – by the time I get done counting, it's changed. So I'm looking for new, unusual, in a lot of cases, hybrids that even like the one I brought today. It's the first one that's been on the market that's been available, and now you got to see it. You know, it's kind
of
neat.
How do you keep track of all that?
I'm not trying to keep track of it. Just keep on going.
You just like coming out and looking at it.
Looking at it, coming out with something, you know, watching to see if there's any variation, maybe setting it aside, maybe trying to get it to a show, get it awarded. Or if it doesn't make the cut, well, then sell it and get more.
Tell us about the care involved in growing orchids. Take us through it step by step.
Well, that's a little bit hard because everybody says, well, just tell me what to do, you know, like you did.
Right.
And there's so many different kinds that we have to kind of pinpoint it and say, okay, your basic orchid is a moth orchid or a Phalaenopsis. The easiest way to grow it, put it in an east window, like morning sun. Water once a week on Sunday at 9 o'clock in the morning. Give it a little bit of fertilizer, increase its humidity, and the plant should bloom for 4 months.
It should bloom for 4 months.
Yeah, if you do everything.
If you do all that.
Yep.
Is there any truth to what you learn about the intangible aspects of raising plants, like talking to them or spraying them with mist of water or playing music? Is there anything to those types of old wives' tales?
Well, I think so. I mean, my plants...
What do you find?
Well, my plants like dire straits the best.
Dire straits.
Yeah, loud, too, in the morning. Start off the day. Wake them up.
Do you blow the speakers right on the plants?
Oh, yeah, as loud as I can get. And then I mist them. And then I water them. And I look at them. And I sell them. And basically, a real orchid grower is somebody that likes growing the plants, nurtures them, and the plant will tell them if you're doing everything right.
What plants do you mist as opposed to water, actually water the soil? Talk about that.
Each one has different requirements for water. So usually what I do is water them, all of them once a week. Some of them get watered twice a week. And then I usually mist them if the humidity is low. And since I'm in a cave, usually I don't have to mist them more than once or twice a week.
Yeah, it's kind of dark and dank down there. Tell us about that environment, the cave.
It's perfect. I have no heating and cooling costs. I have electricity, of course, and I have lots of high-pressure sodium grow lights, and the plants respond to that. Plus, I'm trying LEDs, and they like that even better. And the temperatures are just ideal. They're never stressed. It's not never 100 degrees in there where the plants are getting too hot. The plants are always in bloom, and if I need something blooming, I just move it in for a bench or two, and the plant then will go into flower.
We got some seedlings for our conversation on Twitter, and we are at KCURCST. That's our Twitter handle. Jeff on Twitter says, my wife and I just bought two orchids at the market. Can't wait to get obsessed after just sticking our toes in the water. Wow.
There you go.
Orchids sort of bring out the best and worst in people, as we have discovered during this Orchid Hour on Central Standard.
Yeah.
What strikes people about orchids?
Well, first of all, they're exotic. They're unusual. And a lot of people think, oh, I just can't do it. But you haven't tried. You don't know until you try one. And with basic care and watching the plant, you know, and they bloom for months. And then once you've mastered it, you feel like you've really succeeded in creating something. Then you're ready to advance into other types of orchids. And then it goes on. And then you set up grow lights. And then pretty soon I tell people when you get over 20 plants, you're addicted.
You're listening to Central Standard Orchid Hour on 89.3 FM KCUR. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is David Bird, the owner of Bird's Botanical, a cave-like greenhouse here in the metro area where he grows more than 6,300 varieties of orchids and tropical flowers. David Bird, you give classes on growing orchids. What's the number one rule on identifying a wild orchid and then maybe growing one in captivity from seeds?
Well, most of our native orchids to Missouri and Kansas, there's about 22 species. Most of them aren't very showy. And if you do know where there's a population, you don't want to tell anybody because you're afraid somebody will go out and pick them. And they're usually very difficult to grow. Most of the ones that I'm growing are tropical types. And a lot of them have been grown in test tubes for 3 to 4 years of their life, and then they've been maricloned. So now we have a group of plants that can have identical genes, which are more simply easy to grow for people.
Is this cloning flowers?
Yes.
In a sense?
Yes.
Tell us about that process. You said test tubes.
It's really complicated. You take the tissue from the plant, you put it on nutrient auger, you grow the cells, then you give it hormones for leaves and roots, and then after 3 or 4 years, you have thousands of these plants coming out of the bottles, and then you put them on a greenhouse bench, and you grow them for another 3 or 4 years, and finally, after 7 years, you have flowers.
Is that the work of a botanist? Do you outsource that work, or do you do it yourself?
I outsource it.
Right.
That's a whole different ballgame.
It's like hardcore botany.
Yeah, horticulture.
Horticulture.
Because botany,
like, further on down the line, horticulture.
Yeah, it's growing plants and cultivating them, but I leave that for somebody else to do.
It sounds like an expensive process. Is it expensive to clone these flowers?
Very much so. The individual plants are not that much, but when you think of the process, how many plants you're going to have cloned, how many you're going to get results, you know, most of these companies don't want to mess with you unless you're going to want 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 plants.
So I asked the form of this question earlier. Is there a scientific value to cloning these flowers, or is it merely a sort of cosmetic thing to feel, you know, see what you can come up with? Like, this is a beautiful flower you've brought into our studio here, this harlequin orchid with this sort of firestorm color with the white and dark red, scarlet here.
It's
a hybrid.
It's a hybrid, and it was maricloned. Somebody grew the plant, saw it bloom, said, I like it, made thousands of them, had them tissue cultured, and can then introduce it to the market, and usually at a little cheaper price than maybe what that first one was valued at.
And this other one, as I mentioned, actually smells like actual chocolate, but there's no, you didn't take like a Hershey bar and rub it on the flower.
Didn't have to.
How did it come out like that?
Just a fluke. It was just a cross that somebody made, and he basically got this flower, and he smelled it, and he goes, oh, that smells like chocolate. And he goes, I'm on to something here. And since then, they've produced thousands and thousands of these plants.
So is it fair to say in the flower cloning world or the hybridization world of flowers that sometimes the flukes are the most beautiful things?
Oh, you never know, because when you would make a population, say you cross those flowers, you could have 100 different variations of the same thing. So just like having kids, everyone's going to turn out different. Same way with your orchids when you make a hybrid.
And speaking of something that doesn't smell like chocolate or even flowers, one of the things, David, that's given you international repute is your corpse flower. Tell us about the corpse flower that you have at the cave and give us a primer on why they call it a corpse flower.
Well, it's pretty obvious. If it's a corpse flower, it probably smells bad.
Right.
And usually the flower only blooms for 3 days, and it smells bad during that whole time. And I want to be the first one in Kansas City to bloom that plant.
Ironically enough, there's a corpse flower called Mr. Magnificent at the now infamous Marie Selby Botanical Garden in Sarasota, Florida, that we just learned about. If you're just tuning in, this is a whole orchid hour on Central Standard. That's how we do it. A show strictly about flowers and orchids. We're gangster like that.
Yeah.
Go back on KCUR.org and listen to it, and you can listen to the podcast. It'll be available later this afternoon. But that's an ironic thing. Mr. Magnificent, this corpse flower, they grow to over 6 feet.
Yeah.
Tell us about yours.
Well, mine's not there yet. The plant produces a large bulb. The bulb has to be 35 to 50 pounds before it'll bloom. I think my bulb is between 25 and 30 pounds right now and is presently dormant. So it produces this great big stalk with these big green leaves, and it looks like that for about 6 months, and then all of a sudden one day it turns yellow and falls off.
And that's it.
And then the bulb is resting, and then in another month or two, all of a sudden a new stalk will come out, and it'll do it all over again. Well, at some point, when that bulb is big enough, the plant will produce a flower, which should be 6 feet high by 6 feet wide, and is slated as the world's largest flower.
We're going to send out some flower shout-outs to our flower enthusiasts here. Send us a tweet at KCURCST. What's your favorite kind of orchid or favorite kind of flower in general? At KCURCST is our Twitter handle. You can also hit us up on Facebook at the Central Standard page or at the 89.3 KCUR page there on Facebook. You can tweet in or Facebook in your favorite flower and have it read here live on the Orchid Show / Flower Show on Central Standard. David, what is your absolute favorite flower? I know you have, you know, almost 7,000 variations of flowers that you look at every single day. What would you say is your favorite? And I'll cover these flowers' ears over here so they're not jealous.
Well, mine changes every week.
It changes every week.
And it depends on what's blooming at the time. The one that's today is going to be my Phragmopedium kovacii cross.
Because of what you just heard on this National Public Radio local KCUR show.
That's right. That's for sure.
Phragmopedium kovacii cross. What does it look like? You almost brought it in this morning. What does it look like?
Well, it's going to be purple. It looks like it's going to be almost a dark rose to purple. What we're learning is the parentage of that, by using that plant in crosses, is it makes peach, salmon, and rose. But we want purple. So it has to be crossed back again for the second round. So that's about a 15 to 20-year process to get that second-generation crosses done. So that's where we're at right now. We're just starting to see some of this stuff coming out. And that's what we're shooting for, is that purple one.
I'm a lilac and cactus man myself. That's how I roll.
That's a whole different department.
That's how I roll. How long do the lives of these corpse flowers, getting back to that big six-foot flower that you have in your cave, and that's weird in and of itself to say you have a six-foot flower in your cave, how long do they typically last?
Oh, 3 days.
3 days, yeah. Literally. They start dying after 3 days.
And it blooms at midnight.
And it blooms at midnight.
Yeah.
So this is almost like a Little Shop of Horror type.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Type flower.
No, I'm not going to bloom it there.
You're not going to bloom it there?
No. When it blooms, I'm going to have it someplace where everybody can see it.
What are the sort of environmental specifications that would help it bloom? Or is it just kind of temperamental on its own?
Oh, no. It likes very warm temperatures. So I run it about 78 to 82, high humidity, and bright light.
Is it native to what?
Borneo, Sumatra, yeah, someplace.
So basically the Indonesian Pacific Rim area where it's allowed to be 6 feet and stinky.
Yes.
How did you get a hold of it?
Well, I've got two smaller ones that I got from a friend of mine, and I've known about the plant for years, and I've collected different species of the plants. And so the largest one that I got it on eBay.
You got it on eBay.
Yeah. And then what I did is after I purchased it, I found out the guy that offered it, and I went out to the East Coast, and I met with him, and he told me how to grow it.
Did you meet with him in a garage, and did he have a trench coat on?
No, in his greenhouse.
In his greenhouse?
Yeah.
Okay. He didn't have a long mustache?
No.
Okay, good. So it was on the up and up.
Oh yeah, this was all on the up and up. Yeah, I don't want to go to jail.
You don't
want to
be in a book called The Corpse Flower. So, what are the seasonal flowers that you're grooming up for the fall season? Do you grow seasonal flowers and look to make a big push?
Oh, well, I'm going to have a lot of orchids that bloom.
You're
going to
have a lot of orchids that bloom this year.
Oh yeah.
Tell us about some of them.
Well, in the fall, you deal with different seasons and, of course, different orchids that would, in nature, of course, bloom at that time. And so right now we have the big Cattleya flowers that have the large perfumey flowers that some of the ladies maybe got as corsages when they were dating years and years ago. And I like to get different colors, usually the more bronze, yellow, you know, fall colors, maybe some reds. And then as we get past Thanksgiving, we'll be looking at Christmas, and we'll go more traditional white and try to find some reds. But it just depends. There's such a variety of orchids that it's really hard to pinpoint it.
If someone is starting out growing orchids, is there a particular orchid class or species that you would recommend is the easiest to not kill?
Yeah, the moth orchid. Like
the moth orchid.
That harlequin.
Like the harlequin here.
Yeah, it blooms the longest, easiest one to grow. They're available in all the stores. And a lot of them you see that they call them ice cube orchids.
Right.
put three cubes on a week. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we tell people instead of three cubes, put on 30. Because three cubes gives the plant a slow, painful death. 30 cubes will kill it right down, and you can go get a new one. So we don't like the concept of putting an ice cube on a tropical plant.
And this is something you can grow in any season.
Yeah. Basically, the thing is to use warm water, soak it thoroughly, give it a little bit of fertilizer, and the plant will respond a lot better than with that ice cube thing.
Here's a big question that I think encompasses this whole show on orchids. You've been in orchids and flowers and plant life in that business for a long time. What do you think plant life and our relationship to plant life says about us as human beings? Start with you and then broaden it out.
Well, I'm kind of like at the obsessed level. Like I like unusual, strange, exotic plants. And I wrap my whole life around it. And so I'm probably at the one end. A lot of people are at the other end where they're kind of like trying to grow a cactus or a lilac. You know, it's like...
Yeah, the end that I'm at.
Where you're at. But the thing is, as long as we got you started and you are growing something, hopefully you'll get an appreciation for growing those plants, and then you'll move on to growing other stuff.
Yeah, and I stop to appreciate those.
Yeah.
And that's the first step.
That's the first step. Now, people that say I kill everything, basically what I tell them is, you know, you have to have a green thumb. Well, you probably have to have a little dirt under your thumbnail.
Yeah, I got a brown one, so I'm halfway.
Right, we're going to get, yeah, there you go. We'll work with you.
Our guest is David Bird, owner of Bird Botanicals, which is inside a cave at the Interstate Underground Storage Building. We've been talking about the more than 6,300 varieties of orchids and tropical plants growing there. Dave Bird, thank you so much for joining us on our special Flower Power Hour on Central Standard.
Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow when Dr. Bruce Lease drops in to talk about the psychology of work. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is next with political analyst Sam Popkin, who will talk about his recent book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.